meters at a time. So a 1-watt transmitter across the range, or maybe a 10-watt transmitter doing the signal exciting of your antenna range, and now a crystal diode detector on the receiving antenna into this Hewlett-Packard 415 gives you as much as 60 decibels of dynamic range. On a good day, you could look at side lobes and back lobes that are 40 and 50 dB down with that setup. It is Sedan sensitive, Sedan accurate, and Sedan high in dynamic range. And it's got a very nicely resettable dynamic range. Every time you click that rotary dial, one click, you're moving exactly 10 decibels of sensitivity. Let me drop it. That's the good news. There's one piece of bad news. The way that machine has such high dynamic range is because it listens to 1 kilohertz sine wave signal only. And it doesn't care if it's a square wave. It's looking for a 1 kilohertz signal. Therefore, your transmitter must be amplitude modulated at a 1 kc rate for that system to work. The actual 415 has got a very fancy feedback network inside. It's the amplitude equivalent of a phase lock loop. It listens to a 1 kilohertz signal and rejects everything else. And therefore, it is listening to your transmitter because that's the only thing that's got a 1 kc modulation on it. All other signals in the environment don't have a 1 kc modulation, and to some degree, they're being rejected even though you're not filtering them out. So it's got that advantage, it's got that slight disadvantage. And another slight disadvantage is because you're using a crystal detector to go from your antenna into this Hewlett-Packard 415, you got to be a little bit careful with that crystal detector. In some cases, depending on the brand name and the way it's being used, they're a little bit electrostatic discharge sensitive, although some of them are pretty darn rugged. Most of the Hewlett-Packard crystal detectors that are intended to work in that environment have a built-in 50-ohm load at the front end. Let me drop the front end of the crystal detector assembly made by Hewlett-Packard. I wish I could think of one of the model numbers right now. The very first object in there after the type N connector is a disc of resistive material that represents exactly 50 ohms resistive. After that is the crystal diode detector. After that is a bypass capacitor so that only the 1 kc signal comes out and the RF doesn't come out of it. It's got a BNC connector on the back end. A BNC cable goes from there to the Hewlett-Packard 415. A very convenient method of doing outdoor antenna range testing. The modification I made to that very popular range, let me drop this, is instead of using a Hewlett-Packard 415, I recommend people use the Hewlett-Packard 416, 416. What's the difference between 415 and 416? 416 is a machine that has a pair, count them two, 415s inside. It picks up two separate crystal detectors. The 416 was intended to make much more convenient measurements. Let me tell you how the 415 used to be used. The 415 usually connected to the probe of a slotted line. The probe on a slotted line picked up a signal that got rectified, and it had a 1 kc modulation, went into the 415. As you move the probe along the slotted line, you found the peak and the valley, and the ratio between the two in decibels and the reading on the scales told you what the standing wave ratio was. But you had to move the probe on the slotted line to do that. Let me drop it. A little bit later on, after the creation of the 415, Hewlett-Packard created the 416. Instead of using a slotted line, they recommend that you took a pair of identical directional couplers, one coupled forward and one coupled in reverse, and they're cascaded. And so between your device under test and these two directional couplers and maybe a dummy load, or I think the way you also usually set it up is you had a signal generator going into the pair of directional couplers, one looking forward, one cutting reverse, and the output of those went into the device of the test. Let's assume that it was an amplifier, and you wanted to measure the input standing wave ratio of your amplifier. By having these two directional couplers going into two crystal diode detectors, going into to the Hewlett-Packard 416, it now, the Hewlett-Packard 416 is called a ratio meter. It's a pair of 415s, but it's a pair of 415s hooked up in such a way that you can measure the signal out of port A, measure the signal out of port B, and then flip it over to the third position, and you measure the ratio between the two. It displayed the decibels of difference between the forward directional coupler and the reverse directional coupler. You didn't have to move the slotted line probe anymore. You made the measurement directly, and there it was on the screen, measuring the exact ratio in decibels between forward and reverse, which really is standing wave ratio displayed on that screen. Let me drop. And the next thing you could do with that thing is you could sweep it slowly. Now, you really care about what is the standing wave ratio across the frequency region. Maybe you want to know between 50 and 100 megacycles of this particular amplifier, what is the input impedance looking like? What is the standing wave ratio plot across that frequency region? You can see what was going on when Hewlett-Packard came up with the 416, which is the instrument that was in my article called Antenna Ratiometry, an Outdoor Range Improvement Technique, which I think was 1976. February issue of QST. You can look it up by my call letters. And that's the technique that was then used at the Romare Development Center, their version of it. Let me drop it. Right after I published that article in QST, the Hewlett-Packard 416 meters that were on the surplus market being sold for $15 a piece, all of a sudden they jumped up to a few hundred dollars because everybody wanted one because of that article. I was using the Hewlett-Packard 416. Hewlett-Packard 416, it's so good at measuring the ratio between the two. It's like an operational amplifier. It has a huge amount of common mode rejection ratio. What that really means is that you're displaying the ratio between forward and reverse on the screen. Your signal generator could go up and down 10 or 20 decibels in power output, and the needle wouldn't move. It would still measure the ratio between the two because it had that dynamic range. Beautiful instrument. As such, when you set up an antenna range with that technique, you now are not vulnerable to the transmitter going up and down in power because Con Ed or LIPA are going up and down in their voltage they generated. The reflection of the signal off the ground because the wet grass in the morning is drying out and the ground reflection is changing. As long as the two paths of the two antennas side by side are identical in the way they behave, then it's only the ratio between your unknown antenna and your reference antenna that allows you to make these measurements. That outdoor range, the ratiometry antenna range, let me drop. What you're really doing with that technique is you're converting your backyard into one great big operational amplifier. Your whole backyard is the operational amplifier. A good operational amplifier has a positive input terminal and a negative input terminal, and the ratio between those two signals is what it amplifies, and it has a common mode rejection. If the positive and negative signal both went up by 1 volt, the operational amplifier doesn't move. That's what the Hewlett-Packard 416 does. So all of a sudden, you now have the ability to measure amplitude changes of 0.05 dB, a 20th of a dB of change. As I was tuning an antenna by holding a tuning tool, which really was a small piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick, and I'm holding it near the tip of a Yagi element, for instance. As I hold it near the tip, I'm adding capacitance to the tip. That particular director was now tuned to a lower frequency, and I'm watching the amplitude on that ratio meter. Did it go up? Did it go down? I could measure a 20th of a dB of change in a repeatable manner. You talk to any normal human being that runs a conventional antenna range, even inside of an anechoic chamber. They tell you to get accuracy of half a dB is extremely difficult. With the ratiometry technique, you could rather easily get repeatable accuracy of 0.05 dB, 10 times better. 20th of a dB of change can easily be resolved. The next step I did is not to even look at the meter on the ratio meter, because that's down on the picnic table, and I'm standing up on a ladder, and that meter is 8 feet away from me, and it's hard to see. The next thing I did was to add a voltage-to-frequency converter. The meter, the Hewlett-Packard 416, has a 0 to 1 volt output on the back panel, and that represents the voltage that's going to that meter. I put that into a tone generator where the
repeater, timeout.
The tone generator is called a voltage to frequency converter, which I built it with individual circuits. Nowadays, you can buy one individual integrated circuit chip that'll do that for you. So now, I'm listening to the tones coming out of a hi-fi loudspeaker, and as the gain goes up, the pitch goes up. So now, as I'm waving my tuning tool near each individual element to find out, does that director want to be higher or lower in center frequency in order for the gain of the Aggie to increase, and I'm listening to these tones. And now, I can very rapidly find ways of increasing the gain of the antenna. And a lot of serendipity happens when you do that. Every so often, you think you're going to put the tuning tool near director number 3, and you've done that experiment, and now you're pulling away, and you didn't even intend to wave the tool near and director number 2. But as you're retracting the tool, all of a sudden you hear the pitch go up. You say, wow, whatever I just did was good. The gain just went up. Let's go back and find out what I just did. You'd be amazed how many times you find serendipity by that kind of tuning technique, because the human brain is very good at remembering tones that went up and down. And so you just keep tuning the antenna to the highest pitch tone, and you know you're maximizing the gain. That's how the RIW-19 Yagi came about. By the way, it's one of the things I didn't mention to Dennis earlier. The idea of putting the elements of a Yagi with insulators through the boom was, to some people, a breakthrough, because what had been happening for years is that when the elements go through the boom directly, in the case of a 3-element Yagi, it's not much of a problem. You get to a longer Yagi, like 5 or 6 elements, or above, let me drop. All those elements going through the boom are rapidly building up aluminum oxide. They're eventually going to break contact with the boom, and they're going to become insulated from the boom. Well, when the element was making contact with the boom, and now it breaks contact with the boom, those elements are all now tuned to a different frequency. That changes the tuning. So therefore, you get non-repeatable gain out of Yagis when it's a long Yagi with the elements going through the boom. So my improvement of the design was to insulate the elements from the boom. I originally did it with little plastic blocks sitting on top of the boom holding the element, and each element was held on with this plastic block to the boom by way of a tie wrap. So now I could easily shift the elements forward and reverse, or twist them sideways to find out what happens if that element is not there. And so that's how I developed that 19-element Yagi. And so between 1978 and 1982, among gain measurements on real outdoor antenna ranges, that 19-element Yagi was believed to be the highest gain Yagi in the world, with confirmed gain measurement on a real antenna range. So, and it has become kind of a standard. Quite a few people set up an antenna range where the reference antenna is that 19-element 432 megacycle Yagi, 432 megahertz Yagi. So insulating the elements in the boom gives you a huge advantage, and now the antenna will keep its gain years downrange. So that tells you the 416 and the 415, beautiful instrument. And so of all the things you own, I'm pretty sure you don't own a 416, John. They're a little bit on the bulky side. It's a tube-type rig, 1975 design, I think it was, of Hewlett-Packard, but a very well-made instrument. Huge amount of common mode rejection ratio. In other words, the signal going into the A port and the B port, you can make those two signals go 20 decibels stronger or 20 decibels weaker.
Repeater, timeout.
You can make them go 20 decibels stronger or weaker, and the meter is only displaying the ratio between the two, and the meter won't move because of that common mode rejection. It's got a huge amount of common mode rejection. Very well designed instrument. AC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Coming.
AC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I don't think they make the 416 in an E model. I think it's stopped on the B. For some reason, they didn't keep producing that. But I do have two 415Es, and they can be set up with that using the chart recorder outputs and an oscilloscope. Basically, you can do the same thing you're doing there. By the way, I have a correction on that gentleman's call sign. The printer caused an error. When I looked at the second line, let me let it drop. I'll give you his correct call sign. It's Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray. I left out. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I recognize those calls now, India X-ray, Papa. Wes, you had a question on the subject? Go right ahead, Wes. And 2XJN, K2IW.
Yeah, I'm speaking in the internet. I found K2RIW, HF antenna radiometry, QST February 1976, page 2225. And it's a beautiful picture in here for 10 megahertz. We're talking about a slotted line. That's figure 9695. I believe I see you. I don't know. The guy with the beard. But anyhow, figure 9-4. There's www.qsl.net/n1btwt/thap9.pdf. And I see a parking lot. And on the parking lot, there is a huge tri-leg lifted table and some distance, and then you have a dish. It's a small dish on the table. I was kind of puzzled what kind of experiments put you to, made you to do it, because now you're measuring the height source versus camera-inch length and divided by 4 height measurement, and that is about it. Antenna range with radiometry and 10 gigahertz antenna test setup. Do you recall that?
I don't think I recall the article you're mentioning. There was a QST issue where I'm standing on the front cover on a picnic table holding onto a 12-foot dish. And that was at Saddlebrook Park in New Jersey. Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Laboratories, used to advise everybody doing those antenna gain measurements.
Ball weight N1BWT.
WA2ZZF was his call letters then. Nowadays he's, I think that's his call letters now. He's now a W1. Because he was WA2ZZF at that time, Dr. Dick Jones, W2IMU. Anyhow, I was standing on a picnic table holding onto this 12-foot dish. In front of the dish was a 1296 feed horn, and that whole article on how to build that dish was the August issue, 1972 QST. So that was an antenna gain measurement, Saddlebrook Park, New Jersey. They used to take place in August or September of every year for about a 10-year period of time. The whole reason why the hams were measuring antenna gain on 432 and 1296 is because the antenna manufacturers, we soon discovered, were lying through their teeth. They were all claiming gain numbers that had nothing to do with reality. The gain of those antennas was being set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory. Manufacturers of antennas realized that what people were doing, let me drop this. If a guy's going to buy an antenna, he looks at antenna A and antenna B. He finds out how many decibels of gain does each antenna have and how many dollars it costs. Therefore, he was measuring decibels of gain per dollar. And so manufacturers realized that, and they had to all make sure they had the highest gain number so that people would buy their antenna. And pretty soon they were fibbing like crazy, particularly television aerials. So the guys from the East Coast VHF Society decided to set up these antenna gain measurements starting in roughly 1968, and from then on, for the next 10 or 15 years, guys from about 10 different states would come together, because this was well advertised among the VHF people. They would come and measure their gains, whether they're homebrew or commercial, it doesn't matter. For a 10 or 15 year period, every winning antenna, every one of those years, was a homebrew antenna by a ham radio operator. The commercial antennas didn't win those contests. On a couple of occasions, the gain difference between what the manufacturer claimed and what was really measured was crazy. Cushcraft had an antenna that claimed 15 dB of gain, and it measured something like 8. another manufacturer had an antenna that claimed 24 dB of gain, and it measured 12. I mean, those are lots of dBs of difference. And so because of those results, those antenna gain competitions went on year after year. The results were often published in the world above 50 megacycles. And so to this day, let me drop this. To this day, every meeting of the Central States VHF Society includes an antenna gain measurement on all of the VHF, UHF ham bands. Every meeting of the Microwave Update Group includes an antenna gain measurement. So to this day, here we are, 40 years later, the hams, the serious VHF hams, when they get together, they measure the antenna gains of the antennas because they don't believe any of the manufacturers anymore. On top of that, in some cases, they're developing antennas that have higher performance than you can buy, and they're willing to homebrew them. Back to you, Wes. The article that you found is not my article. I may have given you the wrong month and year, but by way of my call letters, you can look it up in the QST archives. WS2N, K2RIW, here we go, N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
At first I found the HP1 416 radio meter in a museum, but then it's a beautiful piece of equipment, and that led me to get to this experiment. It wasn't yours, but you are mentioned there. They say instrumentation, one of measuring instruments commonly used for amateur antenna ranges is the Vonobel HP 416 radio meter. What was Vonobel about it? And crystal detector used to sense RF. Basically, this technique compares to the output of two crystal detectors. Yeah, you don't. Okay. Now, the article is dated by Paul Wade, November 1, Bravo W. Tango, 1994-1998, and that was at a picnic. There was the parking lot hams measuring antennas for many years, VHF and UHF frequencies, and exactly what you're mentioning. Very few serious antenna measures have been made at 10 gigahertz. The additional difficulties and the frequencies are not trivial. I'll be describing a few tweaks that make it more so. I see in Paul Wade another Dick, K2RAW. Is it true? Enter his ear.
And you asked, is it true? I don't know what the it you're referring to, Wes. Go ahead.
November 1, Bravo W. Tingle is the guy who made this article. It's a chapter 9, antenna range measurement. Based on the article, it's the guy that you know. It says antenna measurement techniques have been well described by K2RIW and W2IMU. The letter also appears in the ARRL antenna book later on and is required reading for one considering antenna measurement. So it looks like that was the time that you're describing only that is dated at 1994-1998. So question is, do you know Paul Wade, W-A-D-E, November 1, Bravo, W. Tango?
I sure do.
Victor Echo 3, November Whiskey Echo.
Victor Echo 3, Victor Whiskey Tango, I think it was. Get to you in a second. Yes, I know Paul Wade very well. He's the guy with his earlier call with us with WA2ZZF. He's the guy for many years ran the antenna gain competition at Saddlebrook Park in New Jersey. When he moved from New Jersey to New England the first time, he was WA2BIT, WA1BIT, and now he's got a new set of call letters. All of a sudden, I can't think of them. Paul Wade has a nearly monthly article in every issue of QST about microwaves now with his new set of call letters. So I know Paul very well. I knew Dick Turin very well, W2IMU. He was now a silent key, unfortunately. And he's the guy who set up a beautiful setup at Bell Laboratories where he was working. He was using the 60-foot dish and doing moon maps. And his 60-foot dish was right alongside of that hog horn that was used by Penzias and Wilson to make the measurement of the 3-degree Kelvin of black body noise of space. One of the things I want to make clear here, let me drop. What's interesting about that ratio meter is you can see the direction that Hewlett-Packard was moving. Precise measurements with a slotted line were originally done on the 415 meter, square law meter. Putting a pair of those meters in one box was the 416. Now, with a pair of directional couplers, you can make an instantaneous measurement of standing wave ratio of an unknown device and do it in a swept manner. The next step Hewlett-Packard came along with is saying, gee, we always keep assembling the same group of meters. You've got a signal generator, directional couplers, and the ratio meter. Let's put it all in one box. When you put it all in one box, it's called a vector network analyzer. You're looking at the step-by-step procedure by which the vector network analyzer came along. When I first got into engineering, everybody on every radio measurement in a laboratory went and got a signal generator, a frequency meter, directional couplers, crystal detectors, oscilloscope. We always were assembling the same equipment over and over again. And Hewlett-Packard had the great idea of combining all of that into one box, and it eventually became a vector network analyzer. It really is a pair of directional couplers with a signal generator with the right kind of a ratio meter detector display. That's what a vector network analyzer is. You're looking at the step-by-step measurement as you study the history of those instruments made by Hewlett-Packard. And they were really thinking, let me drop. They were really thinking about what every electronic engineer in every laboratory was going through day after day, assembling the same kinds of equipment, and by putting it all in one box, they saved us a mountain of time and gave us a hell of a lot better accuracy, repeatable, traceable to the Bureau, and life became a lot easier. You can now, with a vector network analyzer, as I have done in the last 10 years, you can now do a man-year's worth of work in a fraction of one day when it comes to measuring swept standing wave ratio measurements across a very wide frequency region while you're tuning some elaborate object like, say, for instance, a very broadband three-element Yagi. And so that patent that has my name on it for a three-element Yagi, where the standing wave ratio is 1.05 to 1 across the 3% bandwidth of 902 to 928 megacycles. You go to any manufacturer of antennas, and you give them that specification for that antenna, and they'll say, you're crazy. We can't produce things like that. Well, it's now being done. Victor Echo 3, question mark. Please give me your full call letters and name, sir. K2RIW in the Tech Neck.
K2RIW, this is Victor Echo 3, November Whiskey Echo. I am located here in Toronto. I just had my scanner on, and it happened to stop on this frequency. So I looked it up to see where it was, and I figured I'd give it a try. I'm using my handheld at the moment, but I do have it plugged into a mobile antenna. We've got some thunder and lightning up here with a bit of rain. So I'm just listening so you guys can carry on. I just wanted to see if I could hit the repeater.
Okay, Victor Echo 3, November Whiskey Tango, I think it was. Yeah, that's you, John. And so what you've just tuned into is the Long Island program that we have every Sunday night for the last 30 years called the Technical Net. These guys meet starting at 8 o'clock local time until midnight every Sunday night, and we discuss radio and try to teach each other how things work, if you know what I mean. And so that's what's going on. That's what you've tuned into. And there are a number of other guys in the Toronto area, I'm trying to think of their call letters right now, who sign in quite often. John, you probably can remember their call letters. I'm blank. All of a sudden, I don't have them on my list. And not the particular page I'm looking at, where when we get guys from K2 Canada signing in by way of Echolink, whereas I think you're doing it directly. I know that I've been hearing from Barry into MB that the 432 band and the 2-meter band are having an opening right now. So I think you're saying, John, you're talking to us directly. Is that true? Victor Echo 3, November Whiskey Echo, K2RAW in the TechNet.
All right, the call here is Victor Echo 3, November Whiskey Echo, and I may have forgot to give you my name. The name on this end is Brandon, Bravo Romeo Alpha, November Delta Oscar November. Yes, I am using my handheld radio directly to the repeater. I threw it in the radio just a few minutes ago, and I'm using 5 watts into an antenna. Don't ask me what the gain is. It's not a mass amount, but there is some gain on the antenna. And I know you were talking about gain, and I guess it's going to be depending on DBI or DBD. So, yes, I am talking to you directly into the repeater. I guess you guys are only on the other side of the pond, so getting into it with RF is not too bad. However, I am surprised that 5 watts into the antenna is doing it for me. So, all right, I will keep that in mind, and maybe I'll be able to check in a little more often. However, I am going to jump ship, keeping an eye on the weather here and listening to some of the local nets for the weather. There was a tornado watch earlier. I think that was dropped, and now it's a thunderstorm watch or warning. So I will say 7-3 to you guys, and again, in case anybody missed it, the call sign here is Victor Echo 3, November Whiskey Echo.
Very fine, Mr. Jenkins. Now that I got your call letters correctly, Newmarket, Ontario is where you're listed. And according to QRZ.com, nice pictures of you, by the way, you are 382 miles from me, 383 miles. So, with fairly simple equipment, that's really down the road a piece. You're doing very well. QRZ.com has got some nice pictures of you, of your operation. So, as you can tell, you guys, propagation is something really strange from time to time. What I think we're hearing right now is, some people call it extended ground wave. I call it super refraction. By that I mean when you get a moist layer of air down low to the ground and drier air up top, because water has got a higher dielectric constant, water-laden air has got a higher dielectric constant. You get a downward bending of the wave when you get that kind of weather condition. And if the downward bending of the wave matches Earth curvature, the person 380 miles away, like Brandon, sounds like he's in our backyard. And that happens on the 10 gigahertz band, some portion of every 24-hour day. As you go to higher frequencies, where the wavelength is shorter. Let me drop it.
Was he coming in on the east?
I should have listened on the input. I'm pretty sure Brandon is coming in on the western repeater. Brandon, you're transmitting to us on 146.25 and listening on 146.85 is my guess. Is that true, Brandon? Victor Echo 3, November Whiskey Echo, K2RAW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to have to update my QRZ. I have moved from Newmarket down south into Toronto. If you do want to do some sort of Google Earth distance measurement, if you look up the intersection of Bloor and Bathurst in the city of Toronto, So that is where you will find me. The frequency I'm on, I'm actually on a UHF frequency. This radio only does UHF. If you give me a second, let me see if I can find it again. However, the scanner is probably not going to like the fact that I am transmitting at the same time. It is 444... maybe 7.5 or something of that nature. I don't recall exactly.
Hey, what I think is going on, Brandon, is that quite often we get a sign-in from two other guys in that area. Victor Echo 3, Juliet, India Whiskey, that's Jim, and Victor Echo 3, Zebra Tango Zebra, that's Scott. They have set up an arrangement where a local repeater repeats this repeater. I think it's done by Echolink. So they quite often sign in. I bet you know of those two guys who sign in very frequently, and I think you're listening to their Echolink setup on the UHF repeater. Does that sound reasonable, Brandon? BE3NWEK2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, that could be it. The frequency I'm on is 444.075. And there's a tone on here, 131 something. I tried looking it up online, and it showed me somewhere in the state of New York. I'm close to the Niagara region, and I don't know if it's a repeater that's linked into a system, or if it is something on this side of the border. Most stuff up here uses a 103.5 hertz tone, so that's why I just kind of made the assumption that it is indeed on that side of the border, unless anybody else knows for sure. I definitely can't say for sure. I just know receiving the signal was kind of iffy with the stock antenna on the radio, so I swapped the antenna to a mobile antenna, and now I'm receiving fine. So, does anybody happen to know for sure? 444.075.
That's quite possibly the local repeater set up by those two guys, Jim and Scott. I think they're the guys who have set it up so that various people in the area can listen to this TechNet in what I think he calls it the Canadian Horseshoe area. I may have...
Golden Horseshoe.
What was that again, John?
Golden Horseshoe?
Yeah, I think... Did he call it the Golden Horseshoe? Are you in the area of Canada that's quite often called the Golden Horseshoe, Brandon? Go ahead.
I am indeed. The Golden Horseshoe takes into account, I think, pretty much everything from the Niagara region by Niagara Falls. Out and around, it's kind of that little horseshoe-shaped area. So, I'm in the Golden Horseshoe. So maybe that would be it. The Hamilton repeater.
Okay, nice hearing from you, Brandon. And glad our signal is getting out there. So, your RDX sign-in tonight for this particular technical net. John, do you have another one you should go to, or do you think we should go over to the SpaceNet? It's your choice. KC2WGB, the man with the mailbag, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So, Dick, I think it's about time we go over to Paul and hear what's happening. Might be interesting, as usual. But thank you for all that information, and I'm glad I corrected that gentleman's call sign, because it was confusing. Why the printer dropped that I have no idea. But okay, back to you, and K2WGB.
We've heard from IXP before, and I know him, although I don't think of his handle. Paul, I found a couple of nice websites telling you what's the latest they discovered with the New Horizons spacecraft that flew by Pluto, and they're now getting higher and higher resolution pictures, and they're figuring out more and more of the chemistry of why certain areas, the impact, the craters are filled in. I think they're being filled in by nitrogen ice, as I remember, water ice at these crazy temperatures. Pluto is running at something like 40 degrees Kelvin, very cold, minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, numbers like that. Ice becomes extremely stiff at those frequencies. But ice made out of nitrogen does flow. And so I think they're speculating that those mountains are made out of nitrogen-like ice. WS2N, our space person, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
This is WS2N, and around 5%, a little less than 5% of the information has been transmitted from New Horizons. So, according to principal science investigator Alan Stern, he says there's plenty of information pictures to come back over the next 16 months. So we'll be looking forward to that from week to week. Every Friday they're going to be releasing new information. And I'm sure the press conferences will drop off as time goes on. But you'll be able to get all the information through the NASA site or the Applied Physics Laboratory and John Hopkins, which is controlling the flight. So it should be good. And you said Voyager. The ambient temperature around the antenna on the James Webb. So, you know, I have quite a bit of information on that. We always talk about James Webb, so. That's the one with the 21-foot diameter mirror that's going to be put up in 2018. You're correct about the, you mentioned that earlier in the Dick. The difference between the different telescopes, I mean, this thing's exposed. You know, you look at the Hubble telescope, or any average telescope, you're going to see a tube around the mirror. And that's, of course, designed to keep the light out. James Webb, you look at that, it looks like a parabolic antenna, you know, when you look at the mirror. It's just out there in the open. There's no tube around it. And the idea is to, they're not worried about, you know, light like the Hubble. They're worried about heat. They try to keep the heat away from it. It's primarily a infrared telescope. So if your average temperature is on one side of the telescope where the sunshade is going to be. Sunshade is going to be the size of a tennis court. The sun-facing side is going to be almost 200 degrees. I think it's something like 180 degrees. And then, as you correctly mentioned, I think a couple of weeks ago, it's going to have five different layers of this fine, very tough film, but very, very lightweight, called the Kaplan. That's going to insulate the difference. You're going to have a warm side, and you're going to have the cold side. The cold side is where the antenna is going to be. And that's the average temperature that is going to be 40 degrees Kelvin. But then you're going to get the one instrument that they have is the MIRI, their main instrument for receiving the best pictures for the, you know, that's how the telescope is designed for. They want that to be around 7 degrees Kelvin, not 40. So the average temperature is the whole antenna is around 40, but you get down to the detector. That's got to be 7 degrees. So they're going to have a helium on board. But it's not like the Spitzer telescope where you have a 100-gallon tank, and when it's all used up, that's going to be it. Although that thing's still going after many years of operation. Spitzer is doing good. The James Webb telescope is going to have a compressor on board, tubing going up through the, from one side of the warm side where the sun is. You're going to be compressing everything. You got pipes going right through the shield, the shading, and flex connections going right up to the center of the telescope where the detector is. So that's going to be 7 degrees. So you're actually going to have a system on board that to lower that temperature. They call it the cold head. The cold head's going to be attached to this. Cold part of the instrument called the MIRI, the mid infrared instrument. Gonna have the cooler attached to that. They call that a Joule Thompson. I've been looking it up. Joule Thompson cryo cooler. So I'm trying to look at the theory behind it. Trying to find out the pressures inside. You know how it works. I finally found a couple of websites that. At this show, they're running helium. wasn't even too sure. I thought maybe they're running nitrogen or something, but they are running helium as a refrigerant for that. So funny that you mentioned the 40 degrees Kelvin on Pluto. You're gonna have that's gonna be roughly the temperature of the telescope mirror itself. Helium. Interesting thing that came about on the James Webb site was talking about the beryllium structure of the mirror and the frame that it's all bolted to. They figure beryllium is the least type of metal to deform or to compress. So they're going to use beryllium, but it still does compress. So they've done testing where you could leave this antenna in a 40 Kelvin environment, and the shape of the mirror, I call it an antenna, what am I saying? The shape of the mirror is going to be perfect. But if you were to take the same mirror and put it in, you know, here on Earth, and point it up to somewhere and have it look around, it's going to be a different shape. It would be useless, they said. So it's amazing. Into this $8 billion telescope that hopefully we all get to see in 2018, get to the L1 position. That should be, something worth waiting for, that's for sure. It's going to be launched from French Guiana, by the European Space Agency on an Ariane 5 rocket. I want to bring that up, and also we'll talk about Mars a little bit. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's been up there since probably over 10 years now, and they're orbiting Mars, polar orbit, and they're going to use the thrusters. They have low thrusters, medium thrusters, and high thrusters, and they're going to use these six medium thrusters, which put out 22 newtons, or roughly 5 pounds each. It's usually around 25% of a newton is the conversion of pounds, so it's around 5 pounds. They're going to run it for, a couple of minutes to change the orbit, the timing that the spacecraft crosses the Mars equator. The reason for it is to photograph and also act as a repeater for an upcoming Mars mission called InSight. I know we've talked about InSight before, but that's the one that landing on Mars in 2016. It'll launch in March of this coming year, 2016. And what they want to do with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, one of the things they want to take pictures of this thing as it goes down through the atmosphere. They did it successfully with Curiosity, and also even before that with the Mars Phoenix mission. Landed on the northern hemisphere of Mars. I mean, they showed the parachute and everything going down into the atmosphere. But most importantly, to use that Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter as a repeater. WS2N. That should be pretty cool. After that, they'll change the orbit back up to where it is. Right now, they have it crossing the equator at 3:30 local time. Both noon and night. They want to change it to 2:30 and then eventually change it back. But plenty of fuel on board. I mean, they could run the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter for probably another 10 years with the amount of fuel. I looked that up and found that there's plenty of fuel on board that thing. A couple of other topics, Dick, but I don't want to hold it. I mean, if you want to talk about the Spitzer telescope, and they 20 light years away, that one found a planet, not the Kepler, but the Spitzer. That's pretty cool. They're using that now to find an extra planets going around another solar system. And this one is Earth size, but a lot closer to the star. And they said for the next 10 years they're going to be studying the heck out of this particular planet because it's so close to us. It's only 20 light years away. In fact, they've already signed up telescope time for the James Webb Space Telescope to investigate that. You were talking about that before. No, it's pretty pretty cool about it. You know, a lot of people know where Cassiopeia is in the sky. And unfortunately, when they talk about these planets and where they find them, and it's very hard to find out where they're really located in the sky. I don't know if they're in the southern hemisphere or the northern hemisphere. Well, this one that they're talking about, that Spitzer telescope found, is located right near Cassiopeia, the big W in the sky that a lot of people have looked at. Quite popular in the northern hemisphere. And it shows on the diagram where that star is. It's pretty cool to look up and say, oh, okay, right at that star, because you can see it with the naked eye, is a planet going around that our $8 billion telescope will be studying in 2018. I won't hold the thing unless, you know, if you want more topics. I've got a list of them that don't end, including the one that's going up at the end of the month with a antenna that's over 60 feet in diameter for the Navy. Maybe need some extra communications up there. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WS2N.
Kind of glad to hear that, if I understand correctly, the Joule Thompson compressor or refrigerator is going to be used on the James Webb Space Telescope. It doesn't need a tank full of liquid helium that's eventually going to boil away, so to speak. It's going to be running, I think you said, at 7 degrees Kelvin of the detector. What happens with detectors that are used as a radio telescope, that as you half the number of degrees Kelvin, you're literally halving the amount of excess noise energy being generated in that detector. So if you went from 290 degrees Kelvin, which is considered by IEEE standards to be room temperature, and you go half of that, I guess that would be 145, you'd be getting half the amount of noise. And you have that temperature again, and you get half the number of noise. You keep getting 3D improvement of sensitivity as you make the detector colder and colder up to a certain point, because the background radiation of the universe is 2.73 degrees Kelvin, rounded off to 3 degrees Kelvin if you like. That's what Penzias and Wilson measured way back in roughly 1967-68. They got the Nobel Prize for doing that with this Harkhorn antenna at the Homedale, New Jersey. And I've seen that antenna. I've touched it with my own hands. Let me drop it. When I visited Dr. Dick Turing one time, W2IMU, and so that famous antenna, which is now a national resource, it's a national, what would you call it now? National resources. It's got an emblem alongside of it that says that. That made the very first measurement to confirm that the sky is at that temperature. So if your detector had a noise equivalent temperature of 3 degrees Kelvin, and the background radiation of the universe is 3 degrees Kelvin, and you aim your radio telescope in a very quiet environment at that cold sky, believe it or not, half the noise that you detect would be coming from your own temperature of your own detector, and half of it would be coming from the sky. You'd be getting very close to what's called blip sensitivity, background limited performance, BLIP, background limited performance. So the best detectors in the world are the ones that are background limited. If you can make the detector colder than the background of the image that you're visiting, that you're viewing, if it was a camera or a radio telescope antenna, as a kind of a camera, then you are as sensitive as you can get. And so one of the patents that has my name on it is literally that. Dr. Ogieri of AIL, I worked with him. I made a suggestion for a way of getting better electronic performance for a kind of detector he was working on at the time, which was a background limited performance detector. And if that had been made into a product, let me drop it. And he and I worked on a proof of performance concept, a measurement where somebody funded us to actually build a working model. And portions of that model we did make work. A portion of it was assigned to the University of Illinois. University of Illinois assigned it to some graduate students that didn't have quite enough experience, and therefore they didn't quite complete that portion of the project. But had the detector assembly by University of Illinois combined with the electronics that was built by us on the East Coast, had the two of them combined, we would have had a very sensitive detector for infrared, ultraviolet, visible, far infrared radio. It's a very broadband detector, which would have been background limited. What that really means is if you make a camera out of that, ordinarily a far infrared heat detecting camera needs liquid nitrogen to give full performance. Well, this thing would operate at room temperature and still give background limited performance. That was what all the mathematics said, and we came close to building a working model. I'm going to talk Dr. Orgeri into, I mean, he and I can afford it. We should go back to fund that project ourselves and do it at the head with somebody else funding it, if you know what I mean. Once you have that kind of a very sensitive camera, picture a compact, sensitive camera worn by a fireman as he walks into a smoke-filled room. He now can see with the infrared camera through the smoke. He would see the heat radiated by a child lying on the floor and know to pick up the child in the smoke-filled room while he's doing his fireman's work, if you know what I mean. That would be a very handy project. Also, I can see how mounting a camera like that on the front end of a tractor-trailer truck would be very handy. Let me drop it. When you drive down the 405 freeway in Los Angeles area, and I have, there are times when you're not aware of it, but there's a sudden fog that comes up. All of a sudden, everything you're looking at disappears and turns white. If you saw a clear, defined cloud in front of you, you'd know to slam on the brakes and don't go there. Well, they got a crazy weather condition there on the 405 freeway where occasionally, all of a sudden, you find yourself in a fog. And to have visibility through that fog with an infrared camera would be very handy. I can remember one time I was driving on that freeway, and I was seeing rain on my windshield, even though the road I was driving on was completely dry. There was some kind of a weird condition where the moving automobile collected the moisture, and I was getting rain on my windshield. As I said, even though I was driving across a thoroughly dry road. Reminds me of a condition that I saw on my radio tower one day. A nice sunny day, water was running down the three legs of the tower. Up high, there was a high moisture condition, and the moisture was condensing on the tower, but it looked to me like a clear blue sky, and there was no rain. But my tower was creating rain locally. That Joule, if you Google the word Joule Kelvin, Joule Thompson, it's a fancy kind of refrigerator that by compressing and expanding a gas is able to give you cryogenic temperatures. So a Joule Kelvin refrigerator. I hope there's more than one on James Webb because although it requires no tank full of liquid helium to give you the cryogenic cooling of your detector, let me drop it. Still, the Joule Thompson is a physical device. It's a real compressor and expansion valve which gives you the cooling, and therefore it is subject to wear out. So I hope they've got a spare, because to have this multi-billion dollar thing put a million miles in space at the Lagrange point number two, to have its compressor that does the cooling suddenly fail, and now it goes down to a much lower sensitivity, a much worse sensitivity, would be a little bit disappointing. So to run that by again, Paul, I think you're saying that James Webb is going to be cooled with a Joule Thompson. It's not going to be cooled with a tank of liquid helium. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, and the Tech Man?
Yeah, there's no extra tank from what I saw. I can't get that much of a detail from it. I'm trying to get through the Northrop Grumman PDF files. Trying to get as much information as I can on it, but I don't have that. I mean, they've been testing it for years. They believe that it doesn't need any maintenance. They're using, looks like they're not using a regular TX valve, a thermostatic expansion valve. Apparently they're using some sort of solenoid or a temporarily on-off type of thing. But they're going to use what looks like, I know it's not going to be call this, but it looks like a coiled capillary tube in small air conditions. Let's say your window units, you have capillary tubes. It looks like that type of thing. But they're going to make the diameter a little bit bigger and just make it a little longer, just in case some kind of material, something gets